Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. I'm here at Robert Keenan's winery on Spring Mountain, and I'm having a chat with Riley Keenan, whose official title is the Raker of Leaves, and I'm immensely curious, what might that mean?
It was my initial position and role here at Keenan when I was 10 or 11 years old, coming up here in summer between school, was to rake leaves, primarily. Up and down the drive, all the way to the mailboxes and back, and then all the other sort of similar tasks involving cleaning the cellar and organizing barrels, usually up into topping barrels was the top of my skill sheet when I was that age. But raking leaves was right in my wheelhouse when I was 10.
Wow, so I would have expected maybe cellar rat or something like that, more relevant to the...
No, it's just my dad's humor. That's something he finds a lot of joy in, and even to this day it still says it on my business card, so he still takes a lot of joy in that.
I love that.
Yeah.
So this is really quite a magical property.
It is.
And how long has your family had it?
74 is when the estate was purchased and when we got our bond, which okay. is when I like to think of it as that's our starting point. And then our first official vintage with a label on bottle was 77.
Got it. So where did you actually grow up?
I grew up in Oakland. My parents bought a small little house in the East Bay right in Montclair.
Okay.
On Beau Forest in 87 or 88.
Okay.
I was born in 89 and that's where I grew up. I love the Bay Area. There's no place like it, and Napa just seems at this point to me of making this drive so many times. It just seems like an extension of it.
So you grew up in Oakland and here. Essentially, you spent quite a bit of time as a child here.
Yeah, there was an inflection point at some point where this became a reoccurring thing in my life. Because yeah. for the first part of my childhood, my dad had nothing to do with this business. He was in construction and didn't have a totally functional, familiar relationship with his dad at that time. And then a couple things occurred in my grandfather's life that made him refocus and include his son in some of his new plans, one of which included handing off the business in 97.
Okay.
To my dad, who took over immediately, just from day one, took over all operations, every aspect, so including the stipulation was when he took over that my grandfather would have to be hands-off. There was going to be no sort of collaborating, and there certainly be no direction given from up high from my grandfather, just because of the nature of their relationship and the way that my dad wanted to work and the direction he wanted to take. He knew he couldn't, we needed to be a singular vision.
Mm-hmm. Do you have siblings?
I have a younger sister.
Is she involved at all?
I buried her in the Chardonnay vineyard years ago.
I put some leaves over it.
Yeah, and some grapes. No, she's she has sort of flown the nest, so to speak, as far as the family business. She is going to be our first doctor in the family, in the immediate family. So she's just starting her fourth year at Case Western in Cleveland, with right now, I think, a general focus on to become a pediatrician. So,
and you, are you all in?
Totally. Have been for many years. And my first wine job was outside of the business, that is, outside of college, I started on the service side. So I got a job just as a server at Eno Wine Bar in 2013 or 14. And then from there became a sommelier, got certified and generated my own sort of genuine interest in wine that went beyond what I sort of understood, which was very myopic view of wine, which was just sort of to the extent of what Napa produced.
Yeah.
And that job on the service side, especially that wine bar concept and a lot of by the glass programming, our focus was sort of affordable European wines, Italian, Spanish, okay. Portuguese. All of those wines were things I hadn't experienced before. Really, I hadn't experienced much beyond Keenan. It's just all we had at home. And it was important to have that sort of eye-opening experience with Old World in order to pivot back here and realize what a special place this is and how lucky we are to have something pretty unique that really stands out even from the typical Napa style. Mm-hmm. And we can accomplish something pretty cool up here. So going away from Keenan for a while and having some jobs outside of the business but still relating to wine somewhere in that supply chain was pretty crucial for me to understand how amazing it is up here on Spring Mountain.
So you went to college for what?
Political science and philosophy. Yeah. My reasoning, well, when I was 18, 19, this world was still pretty opaque to me. And I saw Napa as expensive and inaccessible to someone my age. And so for college, I figured, let's just do something that I'll never be able to do in a classroom setting again, i.e. philosophy for sure. And political science was appealing at the time because I was, you know, angry at the government. And I thought, you know, America was the worst place, and let's try and improve it by protesting, blah, blah, blah. And, so the pivot back to wine occurred after school.
So you grew up in this really beautiful environment, partially spent quite a bit of time.
Northern California, all over the place. It's the best place in the world.
But you wanted to kind of carve your own space, and in your mind, deviating from, you know, kind of the given, the environment that you were surrounded by.
Yeah.
Was
I think so.
Constructive.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, it was just something my dad did.
Okay.
At a certain point, it was just, you know, it's what he did in the morning, and he got back in the evening, and that's it. And a lot of traveling involved as well, but, you know, with my dad has a particular style about him where, you know, he leaves a lot of his work at work, and when he comes home, he's home. And so, to a certain extent, it was just my dad's job. I didn't realize there was a whole world and culture behind it that you could really buy into until a little bit later.
What does your mom do?
What's that?
What does your mom do?
She's an artist. She's a small studio over in Oakland at our house, ceramicist primarily, and then just volunteers constantly. So she used to work at the Oakland Museum and stuff like that. So right now she's pretty much retired.
Is your dad someone that influences you a great deal? I mean, would you consider him a mentor as well as a father?
Definitely. Yeah. Just, I mean, with so many different aspects of the business, from farming to the winemaking, and then the administration part, the actual business of wine. All three of those, he's definitely a big influence on how I see the business.
So what happened post college? You got a degree in political science, and then what was your next step?
What did I do? I moved to San Francisco, some old high school friends of mine, and I got a job in cannabis, which was new and interesting at the time. It was still quasi-legal in most places in California.
Okay.
So it had sort of an exciting appeal. I thought there was a good chance to make some good money, and money quickly, which appealed to me at that age as well. And the connections kind of just fell into my lap at the time perfectly, where I got hooked up with a guy who used to be a pretty prominent chef in Oklahoma. He came out here and started an edibles company, but very high-end sort of confection candies and very high-end baked goods that so far weren't represented on the market. And I thought that was a really cool opportunity.
Yeah.
There were some other issues with the business on his end, and which sort of resulted in some instability with the business. Then it eventually shuttered and, you know, the same year that I got the job at Eno. But my job for that business was essentially the same as it is here, primarily sales and marketing. So accessing accounts and markets, opening them up for our products, and then maintaining those relationships and account maintenance. It's the same thing. It's the exact same game, except I was just in California, whereas Keenan, we were in, you know, 32 states. There's a lot more flying, but it's essentially the same thing.
So following that, you got a job at Eno.
Yeah.
And that's to broaden your horizons, or just something that came along at the right time, or why did you take that job?
When I was 23, I remember when I was offered the job, I was at a trade event for our distributor in California, Monterey Bay Wine Company, and they usually, for their San Francisco trade tasting, they rent out a press club for a couple hours. It's always a very nice event. And I think someone asked me the exact same question, and you know, what's the next move? And I was standing there with my dad, and I think I was loudly talking about, you know, it'd be kind of cool to just get a server job at like a wine bar, and you know, start getting some hands-on experience with some really sort of interesting things that I hadn't come across yet. And lo and behold, there was a guy there who was the assistant wine buyer for Eno, which happens to be three blocks away from Press Club. It's quite close, and he just walked there from work to come taste some wines at the trade. And he gave me a business card, and he hired me the next day. And you know, there hasn't been much break since then. It's, you know, as soon as the job with Eno was done, I moved to Georgia and I started working for our distributor over there as just a sales rep covering a territory in Western Georgia, figuring out the three-tier wholesale market, which was my first experience doing that. And again, managing a book of 1,000 different SKUs and learning those products and how they approach the market and that kind of thing. So,
why did you pursue that pathway as opposed to just coming to work directly for the winery at full time?
Because there's not much to do here. I mean, we have, other than my dad, we have 4 employees. So there wasn't this giant need for me to come over, other than in the sales department. We always could use more help with representation. And my dad so far he's never hired a national sales rep. He's not interested. He's only interested in representing it himself, or the next best thing would be his son. So that's the role that was sort of available to me at that age, but I didn't think I was ready. I didn't feel prepared to represent Keenan. I didn't think I had the tools or the experience, and, mm-hmm. and representing something like that felt hollow. You know, the focus was turned elsewhere, up and down that supply chain like I'd been doing. So the biggest station that I hadn't had experience yet with was being a sales rep on the distribution side for a distributor and seeing how they work, what motivates them to focus on one particular SKU over another and that kind of thing.
And what are those things? What makes
money
them
and
take?
Trips is essentially the takeaway. Money and site visits that usually include airfare. That's what gets sales reps very excited, and rightfully so, because there's all sorts of tremendously boring sales incentive programs that people spend a lot of time putting together and trying to make the math work, and then you present that to the sales team and they just fall asleep because the incentive is, you know, iTunes gift cards or, you know, some free swag. It's like, you know, the amount of free swag that these people get on a daily basis, it doesn't get them excited to sell your product. And in fact, it'll usually get them to ignore it. The trips to not only get them out of you know, a little vacation time, but it allows them to educate themselves further and expand their sales tools, in particular with a focus on your product, because usually those trips involve visiting you in particular. So there's nothing but upside with getting sales reps on a plane over here. And we're just about to finish a house right over there, which primarily would be my residence, but I want to use it as a sales tool as well for sales reps as an incentive. Like, hey, we'll put you up for a week if you do this, this, and this in a particular time period.
So really, that's the secret to successful foray into distribution system, is making sure
that's one way to do it. And that's the way that I would prefer to do it, because it leverages all the cool things that we already have, which is this estate, the views, you know, the natural wildlife, this amazing setting, and it's authentic. We're not leveraging anything that's sort of vapor and marketing and polish, which is what a lot of brands can and do, because that's what's available to them. They aren't lucky enough to be surrounded by their own grapes on top of an amazing mountain. So we're just so lucky to have those tools that we can leverage in a real way.
What is your general sense of the system? I mean, there's obviously a ton of negativity as far as their performance and functionality and such like that, but you are you're very close to it. You work very, you know, in a very intimate way with the system. So what are your impressions of it?
Of how sales and distribution works in wine?
Yeah.
It's the future is not totally super positive. The outlook's not totally positive for a winery our size, and especially wineries smaller than us. A lot of wineries that are smaller than us have already just given up trying to access, you know, the three-tier system and get into faraway states, because it's just not worth their time. It costs too much money to support that kind of marketing, and they decide their energies are best focused elsewhere, usually trying to build their home hospitality program into something that's totally world-class and becomes very sticky. So once you come here, you always remember it, you maybe become part of the wine club, and then they have you. And that's what a lot of smaller programs do and have to do, because they just don't have the resources to fly around. We sort of, I think, I don't know what the line would be, but we're over that line just barely, where we make enough wine where, you know, we can support flying around and taking some risks in some markets that are expensive to access, and support them until they work. But I think my dad would agree, we've gotten to a point where some of those places, we've reached a point of diminishing returns. And most of that's a result of the mergers and acquisitions that's occurring on the distribution side. Which I'm sure you know all about. And so you're getting to a point where, like on all levels of this business, you're getting to where you just have a few large players, and they have their own internal calculus where, you know, at a certain amount of cases below that mark, they won't talk to you because you're not worth their time.
Yeah.
And for us, you know, on a bumper crop year, we're doing 14,000 cases, but oftentimes less. That's just a drop in the bucket for any national distributor. We're not with any national. We never have been, and we never will. Not because we don't want to, because they won't have us. So with every individual state, you know, we're looking for that sort of, not necessarily mom and pop, but in certain states we are, where they have one van. But we're looking for that independent distributor that looks for products like us that don't exist anywhere else, and they make that work.
What are some of the best states that you've discovered that are a good fit for you?
Florida, Texas, and Oklahoma. Oh. Texas and Florida, you'll find, are pretty consistent states for all the wineries in Napa. That's just what we would do without those states, I'm not sure, because there's just a lot of people that can drink, and there's probably no coincidence a lot of the states that Napa does well in, there's low to no state income tax.
Yeah.
That certainly helps when you leave a little bit more money in people's pockets. You know, there's a lot more probably restauranting and wine buying, which is, that's certainly the case. I'm sure that's related in some way. And then Oklahoma, I think primarily, I mean, they have this very similar food culture to Texas, plus a lot of high paying engineering jobs, low cost of living. I think that's probably related as well. Plus this amazing network that my dad's been able to set up there personally with what's known as the Nafee clan, which is a pretty famous family over there that have their fingers in a lot of different things, but it's a big Lebanese family, and one of them they're one of our better distributors nationally as far as what they do in Oklahoma for us. And then California, obviously, is bigger than all of those. That's our bread and butter, as it is for everyone here in this valley.
Would it be fair to conclude that three-tier system is really becoming very fast? A good space for large companies and really not at all for small businesses.
National distributors, you're at a point where it's non-existent for medium and small wineries, and then the smaller ones have to beg and plead to find someone to take them on. I mean, you'd be surprised the pushback we get coming into markets that we haven't been in a while, and how slowly the distributors make decisions bringing on new products. And for us, I mean, we're established. We're a very well-known brand. We've been around for a long time. And even someone like us, we get pushback. I can't even imagine the headwinds that a new brand would experience trying to get only a few distributors with no reputation, no history, no track record. It's got to be almost impossible.
So you've seen both sides, obviously. Since that avenue basically is shut down for all intents and purposes, what is your perspective on a small to medium-sized winery, specifically in Napa Valley, as far as their pathway to success, building their mailing list, building their branding, their presence?
I'd say the pathway to success for a winery of that size would be start in the 70s or earlier. I don't know how else you would do it, unless you just have limitless amounts of money. Which happens all the time in Napa. You get those projects that start all the time. And I go back and forth with whether or not I would describe those as vanity projects or a legitimate operation. Because you never know what's in the mind of the owner, whether or not they're actually trying to make that business work, or they're just churning out wine, again, as a glamour thing and as a, you know, conspicuous success and whatever else they do in their life. You don't really know. But if you're starting a medium size or small winery today in Napa, if you could somehow find the land, you need tens of millions of dollars, not just to maintain, you know, whatever infrastructure you're establishing, but to allow you to last and keep the doors open while you're making that network and creating connections in the distribution, because it's going to take you years to build up credibility enough where people are going to take you on and start sending their sales reps out into the market and spending time and energy selling your product. It just takes tons of money. Or get lucky and wildcat in an area where viticulture doesn't really exist yet. And the upstart cost is still low. Either way, super high risk.
Yeah.
It's never been a business that's not risky. It's so labor intensive and so capital intensive, especially in the first 10 years. I shudder to think what it takes to start a winery now. My position, all the horrible risk has already been taken by my forefathers, and now my job is to just maintain at the very least.
Yeah.
I'd hope I can progress in some areas, but getting up here when he did, I mean, that's the magic right there. That's the key to success is the timing.
So let's talk about that. In 1974, the winery was established, or at least, you know, that's when you purchased the property. Yeah. And then the idea was to build the winery and to...
Yeah. So, I mean, the winery was really already built. We're sitting on top of the original cellar that's been standing on this property since 1904.
Oh, wow.
So an Italian family, the Conradis, emigrated here and they established themselves on Spring Mountain in traditional Italian form. There's, you know, 20 or 30 of them up here, big old communal family, and they did a bunch of agriculture up here, and then they did Vitis vinifera for trade, and they built this cellar with stones and rocks that they quarried from the vineyard right in front of us here, the Chardonnay vineyard. As they cleared that field, they're dragging the stones up the hill, and then they built this cellar, dug it into the side of the hill, faced it north, so it catches the least amount of sun in the day, and it stays natural cellar temperature without air conditioning, which is super cool. So there were some things that were already standing here. So the winery location was already set. I mean, it's perfect. They picked the perfect spot. This place stays shady most of the day. The only thing that was that really remained was vineyard and site selection. This was really in front of us. This 6-acre block of Chardonnay was largely the only thing that had been recently cultivated for Vitis vinifera. There was a lot of site clearance for the upper bowl, which had never been planted before, to Vitis vinifera, and then our big block cab, which is our biggest vineyard, is about 24 acres. That was also some serious site clearing as well. All sorts of stuff that's wildly illegal today because it's, you know, too steep or there's too many trees or whatever, but, you know, in the 70s, it's just like, get it out of the way. No one will stop you. So again, more and more reason, like, got in when the getting was good, and now everything's so locked up for so many reasons, some of which are environmental.
So how much acreage was in the vine initially?
When my grandfather bought it, none.
Okay.
There's nothing growing up here. Okay. It had not been cultivated since the Conradis abandoned the site in the 30s, right around Prohibition and the Depression.
So you planted from scratch?
Planted from scratch,
and
yeah.
How were the decisions made as far as varietals, row orientation, all the other bits and pieces?
The framework was already set for my grandfather's obsession with anything right bank. Bordeaux. Ah. That was his passion. That's what brought him up here originally. He was the first exposed to Bordeaux through his in-laws of his first marriage in the 50s. And he married into a family that was somewhat successful, you know, pretty well-heeled society types who enjoyed French wine,
okay,
which for him is a pretty early on first or second generation Irish immigrant kind of family. Fine wine was not a part of his life at all. And so it was very new to him. He didn't know much about it. And I think he became convinced that he was a pretty insecure dude, as far as I could tell. And I think he got into his head that his in-laws didn't like him, and they didn't really respect him. They didn't think he was really worthy of their daughter, you know, classic yada yada, that kind of story. And he took it upon himself to learn as much about French Bordeaux as he possibly could. So then these family dinners on Sundays, where they would break out all their awesome first growths, he would have something to say, something to add to the conversation. To the point where he started to, you know, be the authority figure at the table. And then I think an inflection point was reached where he stopped caring what his in-laws thought about him. But his passion for wine and French Bordeaux continued to grow, to the point where it became so obsessed and crazy, and so crazed with the notion that he came up here and did something stupid, such as plant some vineyards in the 70s. So to go back to your original question, grape selection was definitely going to be Bordeaux focused.
Sure.
And then based on hillside aspects, it was, I think it was probably pretty easy to decide that our eastern and our southeastern exposure was going to be mostly cab. And then we've got some pretty interesting northern exposure and even some western exposure that's been dedicated to Merlot up here. What I really thought was a nice sort of exceptional risk and a nice dice roll that worked out great was this little block of Chardonnay. I don't know that it would have ever occurred to me to go for any white wine up here on this site. Grandfather tried to go for some white Burgundy, and it worked. We've been maintaining this Chardonnay, although this was replanted in 95. That's been Chardonnay since 77, I believe.
Were you close with your grandpa?
Not really.
You didn't know him that well?
I didn't know him that well.
Okay.
He, you know, super, you know, pretty conservative guy, you know, Irish Catholic type, I think, and you know, the difference between my generation and his felt significant, just in terms of how he thought kids should act and behave, even when they just come over to his house for a nice casual Sunday family lunch. You know, not too much roughhousing, better not be making too much noise, seen rather than heard kind of thing.
Interesting. Why Spring Mountain? Did he ever tell you, or did he ever talk about why he chose that specific
Water.
Site? Okay.
Yeah. He knew that the raw tools he wanted particularly was elevation. He wanted a place that was pretty rugged. He needed drainage, obviously. I mean, he wanted to mirror the classics in Bordeaux. He wanted drainage. He wanted a little bit of hillside aspect. He wanted some nice southern exposure to catch the maximum amount of sunlight. But primarily, he wanted a place to stress scrapes and build structure and ageability. And so he settled. He got in his mind that he wanted Mountainside Vineyard. I've been told that it came down to looking at sites on Howell Mountain and then looking here at sites in Spring Mountain. And I think the deciding factor eventually was just the prevalence of fresh water all over this mountain. It's called Spring Mountain for a reason. We get the most rainfall out of the rest of the valley. And I think he felt secure here in Spring Mountain, knowing that we have a bankable natural resource that we won't have to worry about ever, presumably. Certainly not within our lifetimes. And Howell Mountain, as we know, it's a little bit more arid. I mean, you can just see that by the tree growth and the canopy of yeah. forest that grows from one side of the valley to the other. And I think he just felt a little bit more secure with the rainfall over here. And I'm sure the cooler climate factored into it too. He was a little concerned about heat, and he wanted to make sure to maintain, he could maintain that great acidity that he needed for ageable wine. You can't lose either way, Howell Mountain or Spring Mountain. We would have been set making some pretty great wine either way, but I'm grateful to Spring Mountain because of the breadth of wines that we can get away with doing up here because of all those weird little off southern aspects that we have, and because of the cooler climate, you can do some really cool stuff up here that doesn't require tons and tons of degree days and 14 hours of sun and southern exposure and all that stuff.
And of course, that precious water.
And the precious water. Yeah, so we get away with a lot of dry farming up here. Actually, all of our Chardonnay is completely dry farmed and has been for at least 17 years now. And then everything else we water really on signs of severe heat stress. So a little bit of leaf curl or some yellowing on the periphery of the vineyards is when we'll give it a little bit of water here and there. But there are blocks that get away with no water, depending on the year. So keeping that yield down if we can.
So obviously at the time, your grandpa utilized his knowledge, his research, but there was probably not a lot of prep work, not soil samples, what they would do these days. It was done on instinct, on judgment. It wasn't really validated by other resources,
yeah.
right?
A lot of feel and a lot of gut.
Yeah. So, but since then, now that all of that intel is available, have you done anything differently? Have you replanted vineyards to reflect?
No. there's been a little bit of shifting of Merlot. We did have a little bit of Merlot in one of our hottest blocks, which faces really just dead southeast. Right now it's only Cabernet and Zinfandel, but we did have some Merlot there, and I think my dad eventually pulled the trigger on that in replanting that because that Merlot would just get too hot.
Yeah.
And it would just, too much alcohol, pushing 15%, gets plummy and a little cooked, and it just didn't seem ideal. So that was transitioned to Cabernet or Zinfandel. Mm-hmm. One or the other was planted over, and that's done much better. And a lot of that's as simple as the decision is this grape getting too much sun?
Wow.
And I think that speaks to how much my grandfather nailed it the first time.
Sure does.
Not much has changed as far as big time focus. Cabernet is still in the big vineyard. We grow all three of the Bordeaux up there in the upper bowl. Chardonnay is still there. Merlot in the lower bowl. Not much has changed. Up until last year when we ripped out an acre and a half of Merlot and planted some grapes we've never grown before. We're going to grow some Petit Verdot, which my dad wants just as another tool in the cellar for reserve cab and some blending and stuff like that. And then we're going to be the first Spring Mountain winery ever to grow Mourvèdre, which I'm really excited about.
Yes.
That's a wine that I grew up just really digging. And it seemed like all the cool people when I was in my early 20s started making just kick-ass Mourvèdre. And obviously now you have brands like Dirty and Rowdy that are just absolutely on fire and which are almost totally Mourvèdre-focused. And so it always seemed like the cool people when I was younger were getting into it. And it's like, what is it about this grape? And then I fell in love with it, and I've been looking for years, been looking for an excuse to work with it. And after years of lobbying, I finally convinced my dad to rip out a very productive acre and a half of poor little Merlot and replace it with the Petit Verdot, the Mourvèdre, and then the total experiment shot in the dark is a grape that I know that Napa's never grown before, ever, in modern history at least, and certainly I don't think the Italians were growing it, but Menthia.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.